Hear now the words.
Greetings. I am Publius, and you, I suppose you know who you are listening to a long-form spoken word presentation on AnonRadio.net.
This is show number 50. I don't honestly know whether to consider that more of a milestone, or show number 52, which is coming up next week, which of course will mark half a year's worth of twice-weekly shows. Anyway, here we have chapters 24 through 27 of Auf zwei Planeten by Kurt Loss.
Okay. No, that's not right either. Something... Okay, that's what happened. I changed the syntax of something. Give me a minute, I'm gonna fix it.
Nature of the solar-powered Martian economy. Of course, he couldn't possibly have known about the weeks-long dust storms which blanket Mars, making the use of solar power there a very iffy proposition. On the other hand, he couldn't have found any alternative. When he was writing, radioactivity was a new discovery, and the possibility of unlocking from the atomic nucleus.
Eight, seven, six, five, four, three, two, one, cut. Quantel, opt in.
Go tape.
This is Publius bringing you a step farther out. Your weekly radio message from the Man and Atom Society.
Okay, I'm sorry for the confusion, folks. What happened is that sometime since my last live show, I edited the name of a directory to have an underscore rather than a space in it. I did not remember to edit the script that I use for this purpose, for broadcasting. It's a very simple FFmpeg. One line of MPEG, but it needs to be edited so that it's looking for the correct file name in the correct place. So, you know, I should have just not used a space in the first place. It's not good practice. Just as a tip, don't put spaces in your file names, kids. It's not cool. Let's see, and while attempting to do some work on the Man and Atom website, I realized that there's something bizarre is happening with SDF's configuration of Nginx. For some reason, switched over from Apache to Nginx a while back, and not to OpenBSD's HTTPD, which is really what I would have expected. And no matter what I do to the files in my local directory, which it should be serving, it just keeps on serving files from some time back, months ago even. So, something is going on there. I left a note in requests, be bored, and don't know if anything will come of it. Let's see. So, I mentioned a couple of weeks back that the nuclear power reactor diagram posters that I had lent to Dr. Ron Neef of Sandia Laboratories had come back. I was in some confusion as to whether they had actually scanned any of them, and they seemed to have scanned some of them, and I did get files for the scans. So that's pretty good. They seem to have scanned basically the ones that were flat and not the ones that were rolled up. Well, when I say flat, I really mean map folded. But what I got were PDFs with embedded lossy JPEG 2000 files in them, which are about 150 dpi on something which is, so 36 by 24 inches or 90 by 60 centimeters. And, you know, so you can envision for yourself what a file size of about 3 megabytes, 2.5 to 3 megabytes means for an image that's, you know, 5,000 odd, you know, pixels across. Anyway, be that all as it may, I have, I have scans for those now. I would like to have higher quality scans. There is a local graphics business which handles things like architectural blueprints, which could scan them for me, but the price quota that I got was several hundred dollars. So that's not a priority, to get 300 dpi or even 600 dpi reprint quality scans made for these posters. That's not a priority. It's something I'd like to do, but it's not a priority for the use of the funds that I currently have available, which are limited. They're good, though. But yeah, these are the posters out of Nuclear Power magazine from the late 1950s, early 1960s. And today's ASFO archive post, in fact, I've included as the featured image when you look at it, the one of the Augusta nuclear station, which was a combined heat and power plant that was built in an underground cavern blasted out of granite in the suburbs of Stockholm. And it operated for about 10 years. It was taken out of service in 1972 with the explanation that it was heat from it was more expensive than heat from oil. Well, this might have been true, but of course you're talking about a prototype installation. So the economics of prototypes are not generally considered as important as getting operating experience with the said prototype. Well, the people in the suburb which was served by it, and don't ask me to pronounce these Swedish names, complained bitterly in the winter of 1972-73 because they suddenly had to deal with the smoke nuisance from oil heat, which they never had to deal with before. Well, in the winter of 1973-74, when the price of heating oil was four times what it had been, they complained a lot more. By that time, however, and I may have told this story before, the heavy water from the reactor had been sold to the Canadians for use in Pickering, and so they couldn't have reactivated it if they wanted to. The key thing to understand about nuclear combined heat and power is that it gets closer to fuel substitution than just nuclear electricity alone. I've been reading an interesting book. It's a series of three lectures by Philip Sporn, an engineer and electrical utility man who rose to be head of American Electric Power. Three lectures given to the Columbia Business School in 1961. Going under the name of Energy, Its Production, Conversion, and Use in the Service of Man. And as an electrical utility executive, you might expect him to be extremely enthusiastic about electrification, but quite the opposite, in fact. He takes some pains to point out that people, unless you have the equipment needed to use electricity, generating electricity doesn't do you much good. And from his point of view, the equipment needed to use electricity, it represents a much larger capital investment than the electrical generation, that the cost of the equipment is much greater than the cost of power, and therefore that the pace of electrification is set by not the pace at which generating stations can be installed, but rather by the pace at which this utilization equipment can be installed. Right, and so if you look at the world today, big chunks of energy use are in fields, transportation, heating, things like that, and those are places where fuel is used directly. And there's people going around shouting, electrify everything, which has two problems. Problem number one is that most of the electricity, the overwhelming bulk of the electricity in the world today, about three quarters, is generated by combustion, generated from burning fuel. So if you electrify everything, but you continue today's patterns of electricity generation, it turns out that does not get you off of fuel. Now, we have non-fuel burning ways of generating electricity. We have solar and wind and hydro and nuclear. And hydro and nuclear are the ones that actually contribute the largest. But even geothermal. But again, you need to make lots and lots of capital investment to replace existing electricity generation capability. You need fuel burning capability. You need lots and lots of capital investment to expand electricity generation to take on lots of new energy demand, which was previously being served by burning fuel. But you need a potentially much larger capital investment to replace all of the fuel-burning energy utilization equipment. Right. Consumer equipment, we'll call it, as a slightly less clumsy term. And so, at least in areas where steam or hot water heating is the norm, being able to take heat off the bottom of a thermal power plant, specifically a non-fuel-burning thermal power plant, which generally means nuclear, although, you know, geothermal and concentrating solar are options in some places, being able to take that heat and essentially duct it through water pipelines directly to existing customer equipment, existing consumer equipment, existing radiators and that kind of thing, without having to replace your whole home heating and hot water system with some combination of heat pumps and electrical resistance heating. Right, you just get rid of the boiler, and in place of the boiler, there's a heat exchanger which works on hot water that comes in on a pipe from the street. That could, at the very least, although it still requires sizable investments, capital investments for the distribution infrastructure for the hot water, at the very least it reduces the number of individual new installations. That's the thing, is that if you want to turn Great Britain over to using heat pumps for home heating, which has been claimed as an objective for a while, bizarrely enough, at the same time by people who reject the use of air conditioners. And I have to explain to you that mechanical heat pumps are quite costly, and in most places they're hard to justify economically unless you are already using, unless you basically already bought a heat pump to use it for cooling. Right. The thing that doesn't make sense is all of the one-way only heat pumps that are used as air conditioners, but not as winter heaters. I say it doesn't make sense. I have one in my own house and it doesn't make sense to me. Nothing stranger than an air handler which serves a gas furnace in parallel with a motor-driven chiller. It's weird. Anyway, basically, electricity accounts for less than 40% of energy end use, even in the wealthiest countries in the world, with the exception of a few bizarre scenarios such as Iceland. And reducing energy use is, well, it generally goes hand in hand with economic stagnation. Economic stagnation does two things. Firstly, it's politically unpopular, which means that it tends, whatever policies led to that economic stagnation tend to get changed. Secondly, capital investments are expensive, and it's very difficult to make capital investments in a time of economic stagnation. So, when you have large numbers of people living in cities, and when these cities may use some form of district heating already, but at the very least, it's very common to have central heating plants in apartment buildings, in commercial buildings, and so on, which use a fuel-burning boiler and then distribute heat by steam or hot water. Then having heat coming from a central power station, a non-fuel-burning central power station, at, say, 120 degrees centigrade, becomes a very viable way of switching those consumers over to non-fossil energy without requiring them to switch over to electricity, without requiring them to make large capital investments, particularly in maintenance-intensive technologies. You know, a water-to-water heat exchanger, or even a water-heated steam generator for low-pressure steam, 110 degrees C or so, it's a pretty simple piece of equipment, and it's a pretty durable piece of equipment. It's not a huge investment, and it's an investment that doesn't require a lot of maintenance. It's going to last a long time, which heat pump systems just plain don't. They've gotten better, but heat pump systems are not all that durable. They require a lot of maintenance, and after a while you have to rip them out and install a new one. A note from me, the last few weeks I did the Generation Atomic Ambassador training, and I've got my certificate now. That's a interesting program, where they try to sort of teach people how to better communicate, with people about complex policy problems, essentially. And particularly ones that can be controversial. Because, you know, you talk about nuclear energy and a lot of people just run screaming. Or they just don't want to listen to whatever it is you have to say. Anyway, I got the certificate for it. The other thing they do is try to keep people who've gone through the program conversing with each other. Now, the way they do that is typically by, like, Zoom meetings in alternate weeks, and then they have a WhatsApp group, both of which are not exactly my favorite way of doing anything. In fact, I'm just not going to use WhatsApp. I'm sorry. If you want to use WhatsApp, that's up to you, but I'm not. But I will try to make a reminder to myself to get included in the all Zoom meetings and just sort of check in periodically, because it seems worthwhile. Let's see. I mentioned before the people in the Keller Independent School District and their banana policy build absolutely nothing anywhere near anything. Their firm belief in the ideology of stranger danger, the idea that nothing bad ever happens to people as a result of someone they know. Never mind that, you know, statistics about major crimes show that they, in most cases, in the victim and the perpetrator, know each other at a minimum. But yeah, and the newest thing from the Keller Independent School District, their school board meeting last week, somebody got up and started ranting about how the Keller Islamic Center was building a refugee shelter which was going to house people who were released from prison in North Korea who were going to be a serious security risk to their children. Now, as you can imagine, this is complete nonsense. The only thing the Keller Islamic Center has had done is have their parking lot re-graveled. But it doesn't matter, because Keller is basically living up to the reputation of a white flight suburb that the people who go to the school board meetings are absolutely out of their gourds. They are xenophobic to the, you know, to the degree that if they look at someone they haven't seen before, they'll catch on fire. At the same time, the Keller Independent School District, their high school, has decided, well, they were going to do a play called The Laramie Project, which is about the brutal murder of Matthew Shepard, a high school student who was killed for being, or possibly being, or being rumored to be gay. And first, the school district administration wouldn't allow it, because that's an inappropriate topic for minors. And then they decided that they would allow it, but only if it were stripped of every reference to anything which would make it meaningful. And so they're going to be performing an extremely Bowdlerized version of a play which, frankly, you know, it rips the whole heart out of it. And so that's, I think, Keller, I'm afraid, is a microcosm of American politics. If you want to know why American politics are so crazy, I think you look at Keller and you see what is going on there. That the discourse in the elected bodies is, you know, despite the fact it's a school district, there is a determination to keep the kids in utter ignorance of anything that makes their parents even slightly uncomfortable to think about, or might cast their parents in a bad light. And then at the same time, the parents are absolutely sure that the kids have to be protected from any baleful outside influences. WX Boss says, thanks for the mail. I saw that C. Seiler on Mastodon, who joined my Patreon recently. C. Seiler has also received the welcome packet and liked it a lot. Posted a couple of pictures on Mastodon. I always appreciate getting those. Of course, I always get myself in trouble on Mastodon because somebody boosts, where I can see it, some kind of post about degrowth, and I respond with, degrowth is genocide. And what's, you know, and what's really amazing to me, what's really astonishing to me, is not that I get called, oh, this is a person with the mentality of a teenage troll, or something like that. It's that the people who are advocating for killing 90% of the world human population, or at least doing away with them somehow. Generally speaking, they don't want to actively kill. When you come up with quotes from people who actually want to actively kill 90% of the humans in the world, they say, oh, well, that person is on the fringes of degrowth. You know, that person doesn't represent the mainstream of degrowth. That, yes, we want to do away with 90% of the human population because we believe there are too many people consuming too much of resources. And, you know, it's amazing how offended they get. I was even told, that comment is libelous towards people in the field of degrowth. It's like, yeah, right. And it's somebody talking about, you know, well, there's the Limits to Growth 1976, which, you know, person saying, well, it's not, you know, We've got to redistribute the wealth of the world. And I said, well, degrowth has nothing to do with that. You look at The Limits to Growth, 1976, which is one of the fundamental texts of the field, and it says quite explicitly that poorer countries have to be prevented from attaining the level of prosperity of the wealthier countries in order to keep them from using up too much of limited resources. And that, therefore, inequality must be increased, not decreased. And because, of course, the character of industrial society has been, slowly and imperfectly to be sure, reducing inequality. Increase, and not by making everyone poor, but by making poorer people wealthier. But, you know, you quote that as someone says, well, that's no longer, you know, that's an old idea. It's not on the forefront of degrowth research. And to which I can only say, well, research has to do normally with subjects which are amenable to empirical investigation. The idea that there are too many people and we have to get rid of most of them so that I can continue, you know, living in a way that I think is virtuous, it's an ideological position. It is not particularly good as a subject for research. Research in the field is not going to be particularly useful or productive. Now, what do I think is likely to be useful or productive? De-extensification. See, I mean, degrowth fundamentally. There's a lot of apocalypticism in the world today, and apocalypticism and asceticism go hand in hand. The idea that the present age is going to be dissolved in blood and fire and only the chosen few will be saved is everywhere around us. And it takes, you know, you've got the evangelicals with their rapture, and you've got the AI heads with their singularity, which is the same thing as the rapture. You've got many, many people all preaching some flavor of apocalypse. And of course, always along with apocalypticism comes asceticism, the idea that you have to purify yourself. You have to give up your worldly possessions, possibly to the person telling you to give up your worldly possessions. You have to purify yourself in preparation for the struggles that are to come. And that is the only way that you can be one of the chosen few who will be delivered through fire and blood into the glorious new age. Right? That's what apocalypticism and asceticism as a combination are all about. And degrowth is the ascetic complement to the climate collapse flavor of apocalypticism, which is a very different thing. You have to understand, saying that the global climate has and the environment generally have problems that are caused by human action and that are affecting humans, and that we humans need to do something about these so that bad stuff, worse things that are already happening, don't begin to happen to us, so that nature doesn't become ever more and more hostile. That's not apocalypticism, that's common sense. But saying we're all going to burn in the fire, you know, that's apocalypticism. It's everywhere around us. And the asceticism of degrowth is paired, inevitably, with that apocalypticism. They go hand in glove. But as I say, the degrowth people get really angry when you say degrowth is genocide, even though they'll say exactly the same thing, they just use longer words and more of them. But de-extensification, now that is a subject where research can actually help us. De-extensification means, fundamentally, what I've been talking about, using less land for agriculture, which means you can't use biofuels, using less natural water, which means you have to provide cities with water from desalting seawater or something like it. Right? De-extensification means continuing what we've already greatly succeeded in doing, reducing the size of the footprint, ecological footprint, of each human being so that ultimately we can reduce that ecological footprint of humanity as a whole and let the living systems of the Earth recover from the trauma we've inflicted. Anyway, send your cards and letters to Post Office Box 1035, Fort Worth, Texas, 76101, United States of America. I look forward to reading them.
7-6